Itasca, this is King Hal Abel Queen Queen. We received your signal, but unable to take bearing. Please.
King Hal Abel Queen Queen, can you read me?
Today on KPR presents Amelia Earhart, The Mystery and the Legacy. I'm Kay McIntyre. Dozens of experts in aviation and Earhart's history will gather in Atchison on Saturday, July 21st to talk about what happened to Amelia Earhart and the impact of her life and her disappearance over 80 years ago. Joining us today is Chris Williamson. He's the producer of Chasing Earhart, a 14-part documentary series on Amelia Earhart. Chris, thanks for coming in today.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
We know that Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared in July 1937 en route from Papua New Guinea to Howland Island as they were attempting to circumnavigate the world. Chris, what else do we know about the circumstances of their disappearance?
Well, the circumstances of the disappearance are sort of cloudy. It really depends on who you sort of follow when it comes to the disappearance and what you believe happened. The United States government, the official explanation of the disappearance is that they crashed and sank pretty close in the vicinity of Howland Island. They were leaving from Papua New Guinea, and that was the last kind of one of the last sections of their world flight. They were going to hit Howland, and then from Howland, they were going to travel from Howland to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii to Oakland. So they were almost done with the world flight, and that kind of adds to the tragedy of the fact that they disappeared mysteriously over the ocean. There was no wreckage. There's no trace of any kind of disappearance. These are two people and a plane who just sort of vanished into thin air. And that is sort of one of the most intriguing parts of this whole story, is the actual point of vanishing. They were in communication with the Itasca, which was off the coast of Howland Island, which was there specifically to guide them in and to get them safely to Howland, because they knew that Howland was like a needle in a haystack. They knew it was very difficult to find. And we have some ways of kind of relating that to young kids when we do our talks. But it's very, very difficult to find even close, even when you're flying close to the island. If the weather's not just right, it can be very difficult to find that island. And what's interesting is, depending on who you believe and what hypothesis you follow, there was a lot of cloud cover, or there maybe wasn't a lot of cloud cover. It just depends. And so we know very little about the actual disappearance. We know that they just vanished after talking to Leo Bellarts, who was the last person to speak with Amelia, and they were just never heard from again. This is someone who was the most famous woman on the planet at the time that she disappeared, and just poof, into midair.
So you said it's like trying to find Howland Island was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Why choose that island then?
It was a good point for Amelia to make. It was something that she really wanted to do. It was very difficult. She was advised that it was going to be the most difficult spot. And in fact, Amelia, in certain interviews that we've uncovered, had said, if we're going to disappear, ironically enough, if we're going to disappear or something's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong in this stretch. And ironically, they disappeared in that stretch, which was really kind of eerie. This is something that we just sort of came across not too long ago. But she did have reservations. She was very this is a woman who was very confident. She's very fearless. You know, if she ever did fear anything, she was really an expert at masking it. But she did have really sort of intimate reservations about making this island, and she knew that this was going to be the most difficult spot. So, but Howland was there because it was a good midway point. It worked with their fuel. It would have made sense for them to stop there, refuel, regroup, maybe rest up a little bit, and then make the extended flight to Hawaii. So it just kind of made sense from a mathematical and geographical standpoint.
Given the fact that she was a little apprehensive about that leg of the journey, why weren't there more precautions made or arrangements to make sure that they were able to find that island?
That's a good question. A lot of our project guests who have said that if they were planning the flight, or if they were part of that group that was working on the flight, they would have not only had the Itasca there, which is a very qualified ship with very qualified personnel. Leo Bellarts was one of the best radio men in the world at the time. They would have had ships and Coast Guard cutters that were closer in that could kind of sort of guide her, almost like little points that she could hit. When she started seeing the trail of ships, she would know that they were on the right route. However, that's a question that's just kind of speculative. I don't know if we know exactly why there wasn't more precautions. I think that they felt that they had it in hand. You know, Amelia was more than an adequate pilot. She knew what she was doing. Fred Noonan was the best celestial navigator at the time. If you were going to have a navigator in the plane with you on a flight like this, that was the man you wanted to have in the flight with you. And they had the Itasca, which was just a Coast Guard cutter that was their sole responsibility was to guide that Electra into Howland Island. So I think they felt that maybe they had everything under control, and they were taking the necessary precautions. I mean, you got to keep in mind this is in the middle of the Great Depression when this happened, so they probably didn't have as much to play with as far as the funding is concerned. This was a worldwide flight. They had already spent a lot of money on repairing the Electra, which delayed the flight initially because she ground looped the flight, the plane in Hawaii. So when that happened, they had a lot of unexpected repairs that they had to put into the plane. That may have been some of the budget towards some of the rest of the flight. You know, we're not really sure.
You just used the term ground looped their plane in Hawaii. What does that mean?
So the best way I can describe a ground loop is if you've ever been at a grocery store and you take an empty cart and you push the cart and the cart starts to spin, that's sort of what a ground loop is, but on an aeronautical standpoint. So what happens is she was getting ready to take off in Hawaii, and one of the wheels actually kind of broke off from underneath her, and the plane spun, and then, of course, it crashed on Ford Field in Hawaii. And when that happened, then she, you know, there was a lot of damage to the plane, and at that point, they had to put a lot of money into the plane. So the ground loop was not part of the deal, but it was something that was fairly common. If some people say that she ground looped the plane on purpose, there's a lot of rumor and innuendo on, you know, was she kind of, you know, doing this on purpose to reroute the flight? Was she a little nervous? Was she scared in any way? Some people just say, look, she did everything right. This just kind of happened, and it just is what it was, and it just one of those things. So the official story is, you know, there was an accident. She ground looped the plane, the Electra, and they had to repair it. And that also delayed the flight several months, which also could have proven to be a fatal error. We might not be having this conversation at this point if she was able to go the route she wanted to go and go west to east instead of east to west. So that's kind of one of those things that is just speculative. We'll never know.
Chris, you just used the term speculative. In fact, you've used it twice now. I'm curious, 80 years later, after her disappearance, what is there left to learn about the circumstances of their disappearance beyond just speculation?
There's a lot, really. And that's kind of one of the most fascinating aspects of Chasing Earhart and what we're doing. Because we're bringing so many people together, because we have such a robust kind of project, we're able to learn a lot about the Amelia Earhart disappearance. I've argued that the legacy and the disappearance are separate. You know, you can remove the disappearance and then you can leave the legacy and it can stand on its own. Some people disagree with that and say that you can't really have the legacy without the disappearance. It's sort of a gray area and they go hand in hand. I think there's a lot to learn based off of any kind of piece of tangible evidence that comes out to support any one of the varying hypotheses regarding the disappearance. There's so many out there that are being worked. And because of that, there's always new pieces of information. There's new little crucial pieces there's new crucial clues, rather, that come out. That just kind of, it's like a breadcrumb thing. And last year, during the disappearance, the Jaluit dock photo came out that was, you know, set the world on fire. And then the History Channel documentary dropped in July, or a little while after that. And it just, you know, it was this huge thing. The Japanese capture hypothesis has been something that's been around since the 60s. And then you had the Dr. Jantz report that came out not too long ago, which was, he's an advocate of the Nikumaroro hypothesis, which is the castaway that they end up on an island, which is, you know, one of those ones that's really popular out there. And so every time a piece comes out, there's just more speculation. There's more pieces of information that kind of follow that. And it becomes something that's really kind of exciting again. It makes people, if there's one thing that I've learned about every piece of information that comes out, it's that when something comes out, the entire world sits up and pays attention. When, to case in point with the documentary, with the Lost Evidence Project, almost 5 million people saw that. It was one of the highest rated cable shows of the year. So truthfully, the world still very much cares about the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. And I think because it's such a mystery as to what happened to them, and they just disappeared and there's no evidence, and people are starting to piece things together in varying hypotheses, it's exciting and people just kind of can't let go of it. It's one of those things that when it gets you, it has a stranglehold on you and it just kind of doesn't let go. It's one of those obsessive cases, not unlike the Abraham Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth assassination, JFK, Oak Island. I mean, you can kind of go on and on and on, but it's one of those.
I'm glad you mentioned some of those, because as you're speaking, it occurs to me, how do you avoid the pitfall of falling into conspiracy theories?
That's a great question. When we first started this project, so first of all, to give a little bit of exposition, I did approximately 9 years of pre-research before we reached out to any one person, because, and I did that for two reasons. One, I wanted to make certain that I could keep up with these people that we'd be interviewing because they're the smartest people in the world at their field in their respective areas. So I wanted to make sure that I could ask them relevant questions, I could challenge their hypothesis in a respectful way, make sure that they can kind of challenge their own thinking in a brand new way. And two was because we knew that we wanted to put a specific business plan kind of into play with this particular project. And what's interesting about Chasing Earhart, and one of the things I think that separates us from everybody else out there, is that we don't have an iron in this fire. We have no bias for any one of the hypotheses out there. We are completely neutral. And I think that's one of those things that can, it's great for us, but it drives certain people nuts because people just want to know, well, what do you think? What do you think happened? And that's not the point. The point isn't for us to tell you what we think happened. The point is for us to compartmentalize everything, put the complete puzzle out there for everybody for the first time ever, and then step out of the way and let people decide for themselves what they believe happened. Because without a smoking gun, without pulling the Lockheed Electra out of the water in the depths of the ocean or finding it off of Nicomoro or whatever the case is, it's speculative. It's one of those things where it's most of this case is circumstantial evidence. And the irony here is most of these people that have a hypothesis have different types of information that they're basing the hypothesis off of. So if you look at it like a jury trial case and you see that the group Tiger, International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, over 30 years, they've built this little case brick by brick of circumstantial evidence. And, you know, building a case is like building a house. You have to do it brick by brick. And that's what they've been doing. You have on the opposite side, the Japanese capture hypothesis, which is built into historical record when you talk about the ancestors in the Marshall Islands. They know that Amelia and Fred were there. It's just part of their history. They have postage stamps. They're trying to erect a statue right now for it. It's just, they could tell you as easily as I could tell you, look, my car's right outside. I can walk you right to it. It's just, it is what it is. And you have a lot of those eyewitnesses. So you have circumstantial evidence, eyewitness testimony, and then you've got something like the Irene Bolam hypothesis, which has a lot of forensic data and photographic overlay and some eyewitness testimony as well. And it's not very different from the Japanese capture, other than the fact that one of those options she lives and one of those options she dies. So it's a really interesting kind of hypothesis in and of itself. And then you've got something like the Buka hypothesis, which we've helped sort of introduce through the Chasing Earhart project, which is ran by Bill Snavely, who has done a lot of great work on that. And he happens to be the only investigator of any of these people that actually has a plane. He's found a plane that cannot be accounted for off this island of Buka, which happens to be right en route back to Papua New Guinea. And his theory and his hypothesis is really intriguing in and of itself as well. And so you have all these people that come together that have all these different options of what happened to her. And for us, we have to sort of stand back. So as far as avoiding pitfalls, it's really quite easy for us to kind of just put it out there and just kind of be the group of people that's saying, look, these are all your options. This is what it is. Now you decide what happened. And I think it's sort of kind of fitting because if we don't find her and Fred Noonan, if we don't find the plane, if the smoking gun never gets found, if we assume that that's never going to happen, then all you have is this evidence and these theories and these hypotheses. So you have to decide. And I think it's sort of bittersweet because Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan sort of belong to history now. So they belong to all of us. So many people want to rewrite that ending because a lot of people don't believe that she just ran out of gas and that was it. That very well could be what happened, but there's just so much more to that story. And I think, you know, you've got almost 81 years now of this disappearance, and the legacy of the disappearance now has its own piece now that's going. And it's one of those things that just people cannot let go of until they find the absolute evidence, which is going to be difficult to find.
Chris, you're producing this documentary, Chasing Earhart, on Earhart's disappearance. What are some of the topics that you cover over the 14 episodes of that documentary?
So what we're doing is we're sort of working that out right now logistically because there's so much information. It's funny that you mentioned that because when you look at Earhart's professional career, it's 9 years long. You would think that, and we have project guests, that's why I can say this, that you could knock this out really easy in like an hour episode. Like, oh, she flew for 9 years, no big deal. We can get this taken care of. There's a lot of collectors out there that have been working on Earhart memorabilia that thought they could collect everything there was and know everything there was to know about Earhart. And 25 years later, they're still collecting. They're still going. So for us, it's about the way she lived, not the way she died. Because so many people concentrate on that last few hours of the flight and then what happened after that nobody knows. So what we're doing is we're focusing from really going from the cradle to the disappearance and then everything beyond that. So we're focusing on the little intimate stories. And the way we're doing this logistically is finally giving light to some areas of Earhart's life that weren't really publicized. The fact that she has a really major connection to Canada and was a nurse up there and was a social worker and was going to be in the medical field before she became a pilot. The fact that, you know, she has a really deep-rooted history in Atchison, Kansas, which is just about an hour from where we're sitting right now. She was born and raised there by her grandparents. She loved being there. She came back there in 1935 for the last time before, and they gave her a big parade and everything. It was really great. We've talked to some people that were actually at that parade that met her when they were little kids and still remember that, which is pretty remarkable. And then, you know, we have pieces of the puzzle, pieces of Earhart's life that a lot of people don't talk about, like her relationship with George Putnam. It's discussed, but what we're going to do is we're going to dedicate an entire episode of the documentary strictly to George Putnam. Because
her
without
husband.
George Putnam, right, George Putnam, who was her husband, who was her business partner, and then, of course, eventually her husband, who asked her to marry him six times before she said yes, finally. This is a man who saw somebody he wanted and wanted beyond business, wanted for his life. And he died penniless. I mean, he loved her very much. This is a man who took care of her mother after she disappeared, didn't have to do that. And so it's safe to say without George Putnam, there would not be an Amelia Earhart, at least not in the way that we know her now. And we're also dedicating episodes to Fred Noonan, who gets lost in all of this. There was a second person on that plane that a lot of people don't really kind of give their you know, his ready due or his due that he's earned. And this is a man who was the greatest navigator in the world at the time, who a lot of people just knew this was the man. If you're going to have a flight like this, he was who you'd want to have. This is a man who was newly remarried at the time of the disappearance. So he was starting to kind of build a second life, so to speak. He was going to open up a navigation school once they returned. He was kind of utilizing the flight as a way of sort of gaining him some momentum towards that navigation school. He had a really interesting relationship with Amelia. He respected her very much. They both respected each other. He did have a drinking problem, but that is something that's been, again, argued and documented on various parts in both ways. So we're doing an episode for Fred Noonan. We're also doing an episode dedicated to just her work at Purdue specifically, because people know that she was at Purdue, but they don't know really kind of to the extent. So all the episodes are going to be kind of broken up into those different types of parts. Every hypothesis is going to have a dedicated episode. So when you kind of get to all that, you start to fill up those 14, 15 episodes really quick. And we're toying with the idea of a 15th episode, but right now it's just we're at 14 and we'll see kind of where we go with that.
Okay, but 14, really?
14.
Ken Burns did it, Teddy, Eleanor, and Franklin Roosevelt in just 10 episodes.
Yeah, we might be a little crazy. I think it warrants it. When you look at all the stuff, if you put all the puzzle pieces on there and you put everything that kind of comes into play, it's really sort of twofold for us, because we want this to be the largest scale. It is the largest scale documentary project ever done, hands down. But we feel that there's just so much there when it comes to Earhart and her life. And, you know, you have this woman who disappeared at 39, and then you have going on 81 years of a legacy of this disappearance that is just, it's hotter than it's ever been. And it just keeps going. And it's one of the biggest mysteries of all time. And you have all these players and all these people that are involved in this, all these characters that are there. And so we feel that it's absolutely worthy and really quite easy to, you know, to fill up 14 episodes. It's not going to be that difficult as far as content's concerned.
I'm visiting with Chris Williamson. He's the producer of Chasing Earhart, a 14-part documentary on the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. Again, she disappeared over 80 years ago. Chris, why do you think more than 80 years later, Amelia Earhart still holds such a place in our hearts and imagination?
That's a question I ask at the end of every one of our podcasts to every guest, because it's a concrete question, and I think it's really important. If I could put it into one word, I would say the word would probably be hope, and that's probably why she resonates so much. It's a word you don't really hear other than when I say it. But the reason why I say hope is because we found this out in our project. This isn't something I'm speculating on. This is actually accurate here. I mean, we see these kids. They have these various Earhart statues around Atchison, and there's one in Town Square. And there's this photo that this one of our project members who likes the project and follows what we do sent us this photo of her daughter, who was, I think, 9 or 10. And she took this shot of her daughter looking up at this statue with her arms around it. And she had her goggles on and her air flight goggles on. And she was just beaming. And you see this photo and she's connecting to Amelia Earhart, somebody who's obviously no longer here, but here in spirit. The soul and spirit of Amelia Earhart, I think, still resonates, and it still kind of flows through the young women that we have on this project, like Abigail Harrison, astronaut Abby, like Shasta Ways, like Jessica Cox, like Amelia Rose Earhart, like all these people that we have involved. Cassie Pacall is another one. It just goes on and on and on and on. And I think, you know, she really kind of inspired hope in kids at the time when she was doing this that really maybe didn't have a lot of hope, that maybe didn't think they could do the things that they can do. I remember talking to Susan Butler, who wrote East of the Dawn, which is one of the defining biographies of Amelia Earhart, if not the defining one. And she told me that when she was doing research for the book, and this is a while back, that she would receive letters from women who were attending Purdue at the time that Amelia Earhart was there, and remember Amelia Earhart being in their classes discussing various aspects of, you know, women in aviation and engineering and all that stuff. And the letters would say, look, I was planning on being just getting a regular degree and being a homemaker, or I was just going to, you know, just to get a degree to have a degree, or I was going to do something totally different. And then I heard Amelia Earhart speak, or she attended some of my class and she did some lecturing, and I decided to become an engineer instead. And I decided to fly instead. And I decided to do all, you know, mathematics instead. And what's really interesting about that is you have this explosion of something called STEM that everybody probably knows right now. Amelia Earhart was a pioneer in STEM without ever even really knowing it, before STEM ever existed. She was encouraging women to get into science, technology, engineering, mathematics. That's what she was doing. So her impact and her legacy and the ripples of that are just stunningly and embarrassingly, almost at a certain point, obvious in 2018. And you see all these things that are just out there like this, all these women doing these great things. And I think that they all draw inspiration from a woman who disappeared 81 years ago. And I think because she disappeared, and I'm going to steal a quote from Michelle Albion, who was just recently on our show, and she put it really great. Because she disappeared at 39, she never turned into like a curmudgeon. She never got really old. We never saw her like in her, you know, kind of wither and get older and stuff. She disappeared in this perfect state at the height of her popularity, at the height of her importance, at the height of her legacy. She disappeared. It's just like someone just walking off the face of the earth and just, that's it. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to think that she just flew off into the sunset. There was nothing left for her to accomplish. And so she just flew off and took off, and that was it. So I think people sort of get what they get from her, but I believe that people come to her for different reasons. And it's, if you look at our project and you listen to the guests we have on our show, it'll become abundantly clear to you of why she's still relevant.
Chris, how did you become interested in the story of Amelia Earhart?
So, Amelia Earhart sort of comes to everybody, like I always tell people, third grade seems to be sort of like the magic time for Amelia Earhart to be introduced to her, second and third grade in that time. And for me, it was, and again, another question I ask, I ask this question every podcast, every guest we open with this, and it's a two-part question. And what it is, do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart? And then when did she come into your life professionally? Because that's always a great icebreaker, because we kind of get into it that way. For me, it was a History Day project. Like so many people shared this story, but it's really pretty common. But I remember specifically that we had a teacher in third grade that the way she introduced us to icons of history, she'd used 8x10 photographs and she put them up all around this really, you know, our classroom. And we would be asked to do a History Day project on one of those people. And you had your Harriet Tubmans, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, like all the greats, all the people that were really important, George Washington. And you had Amelia Earhart, and nobody had picked her after a couple of days, and because nobody really knew who she was. And so I picked her, and it's the famous bomber jacket photo that everybody's probably seen if you Google image search Amelia Earhart with her hands on her hips in the bomber jacket. It was taken by Albert Bresnik. And I just sort of fell in love with her story and the inspiration and kind of what she had to go through and the glass ceiling that she had to forcefully shatter. She was certainly not the first pilot. She was the 16th woman to get her pilot's license. So there were 15 women that came before her that were icons and pioneers in their own right. And we'll be dedicating this podcast and this documentary to those women, of course, along with Amelia. But Amelia was the one that came through and shattered the glass ceiling so everybody could follow behind her. And that ripples to this day. People still follow Amelia at this point. So for me, it was just one of the things I just kind of fell in love with when I was in third grade. And I remember doing project after project. Every year, History Day project would come around. I just keep doing another aspect of her life. I just kept following this woman, which is really kind of strange for someone that young. But it got, the ideas eventually got more complex and the thoughts became more intimate. And I started writing papers on her and did a dissertation on her and all this other stuff. It just kept going and going and going. And then oddly enough, it sort of went away for a little while. I mean, she never left my consciousness or my horizon, but it kind of went away for a little while. And then around 2008, 2009, maybe something like that, I started doing pre-research for what would become Chasing Earhart with no name, no business structure, no anything at all. So she's always sort of been, since I was a kid, sort of part of that consciousness that I have, and it just kind of never left.
So what you're saying is your parents probably had a deep sigh and said, oh gosh, Chris didn't outgrow that childhood crush after all.
Yeah, some people would call it a childhood crush. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say that it's just, I'm sort of really, you know, it's weird how it a project like this sort of evolves, because you start out with a business plan, you start doing it a certain way. And I started to get more aggressive as we got into this, especially over the last year, because I thought, no, you know what, as I started gathering these examples and talking to these women that were just inspired by her and that were doing these things, that were doing great things for themselves and making a difference in her, something that she would sort of, we always have this hashtag on social media that Amelia would be proud. And we use that a lot. Our team does, because there's so many women doing these great things. As I started collecting these stories, and we started talking and shooting with these women as a team, I started getting more aggressive as to why I wanted to tell this story. It's like, no, this story needs to be told. But it needs to be told from a standpoint in the way that we're telling it. Most of the time, these documentaries and these projects on Amelia Earhart, they go one of two ways. So they either are extremely glossy. So they'll say something like the top five theories on the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, and it'll be like a 30-minute program, and there's like 70 years of research in that. And it's like, there's no way you can fit that in 30 minutes. Or it'll focus on one aspect of the disappearance, and it'll be extremely biased and leaning towards that aspect of the disappearance. No, this is what happened to her unequivocally, but they don't mention anybody else. And so you have these big organizations like National Geographic and all these places that do those kinds of documentaries. And we thought, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it unlike anybody else, and we're going to do it with a non-biased platform. We're going to do it this way. We're going to treat the disappearance as if everybody has equal playing field, as if everybody has equal information, because they do. And a lot of people will challenge us on that. How could you give such and such the same attention or keep that in the same playing field as this other hypothesis, because this one's based strictly on science and we all know this. And I totally get that and I respect that. But we also respect the work that everybody's done over the last 50 plus years, 60 plus years, people that have went to their graves knowing like they know that this is what happened. And so we want to honor those people's research and honor Amelia through that research and just let people decide. I think people, the more you talk to people, the more you kind of find out that these kids that continuously write to Amelia Earhart still, the Birthplace Museum still gets letters from little girls from writing to Amelia Earhart thinking she still lives there. They are writing her story for her. They believe that she flew off into the sunset, or they believe that she retired, or they believe that she went and got married, or they, whatever they believe. That's not the point. But the point is that they still want to write that story. And I think, you know, there's a really good story behind that. And there's a reason that we should be doing this. And so that's kind of why it drives us. And I think that's really important for us to tell. And I think if we're the team to tell it, then that's what we're going to do.
Chris, in all the research you've done on Amelia Earhart, what's the one thing about her that you find really interesting or that really sticks with you?
She was sort of like she could walk a really interesting fine line. And this goes kind of takes a turn to this piece of footage that we just recently were very blessed to be able to donate to the Amelia Earhart Airport Museum in Atchison there. There was a little boy when he was 4 years old, he's still alive, he's 85 now, who met Amelia Earhart. His name is Dennis Gray. And he contacted one of our project guests, Doug Westfall from the Paragon Agency, who's a national historian. He published 9 Earhart books, and that's just kind of what he does. And said, look, I met Amelia Earhart when I was a kid, and I can prove it. And so that kind of piqued Doug's interest. And he said, well, how can you prove it? He goes, well, my dad shot it. My dad filmed it. And they were actually at an airport. And they went out there to see this lion. Their father had this new, you know, this new video camera, and they heard there was a lion at the Burbank airport. And back in those days, airports would do like little stunts like that to get people to come out to the airport and stuff. And so him and his sister and his little sister and his family go out there. And sure enough, lo and behold, there's a lion in a cage at the airport. And this is all on film, and we have it. It's on our website and you can see it. And so they're looking, and their father is just kind of filming B-roll footage. He's just kind of like shooting the airport and different things. And after a while, they walk over to this hangar, and you see this big plane. And sure enough, it's a Lockheed. It's a Lockheed Electra 10E plane. And he's shooting it, and they're loading luggage and stuff into the plane. So this is, you know, right before they take off to Hawaii on the world flight. So this is like March 2, March 3, something like that.
So he didn't just meet her. He met her.
He met her right before they were getting ready to leave. Yeah, which is really kind of crucial. So this little film clip ties together so many different little threads, which we can get into in a second. But what's really interesting is he meets her. He's in the foreground. And sure enough, who walks out but Amelia Earhart? And she's got her full bomber jacket on and everything. Like, she's getting ready to go. Like, they're almost time. It's almost time to take off. And she walks over to him and she shakes his hand. And in this video, you see this little four-year-old boy who's got his hand in his eyes because the sun's right in his eyes, shaking hands with Amelia Earhart. And Amelia Earhart's got this big smile on her face and everything. And she kind of shakes hand with him for a few seconds. And then she kind of, you know, drifts off and gets back to what she was doing. But according to Dennis, she dropped what she was doing and walked over to him to talk to him. And so what's interesting about that, and what to get back to your question about what do I find the most interesting about her, is she was able to hang with the men. She could, as my dad used to say, cuss like a Marine Corps DI around men. She was really like, she was one of the boys when she needed to be. She was very fascinated about, you know, the way airplanes work. She was very involved in her flights. She was a rough and tumble tomboy when she was a little girl. But she could also be very gentle, and she could love, she was very good with kids. She loved kids. She taught her stepson how to drive in the 1932 SX Terraplane that is going to be coming to Atchison in just a couple of weeks. So she loved kids. She was really great with them. She was a great speaker. She had all these different lines that she could walk. And I've asked people that are authors that are much more intelligent at this than I am to ask to get their opinion on, was it like a light switch? Was it like Marilyn Monroe, where she could just turn on Marilyn Monroe when she wanted to and just be like her whenever she wanted to? Or was it just something that was just part of different little aspects of her personality? And the resounding answer to that is it was just who she was. It was there was just different aspects of her personality. She was, so it's a character trait that a lot of people don't really have. They're usually one way unilaterally with everybody for the most part, but she could sort of play those different parts and she could play those different roles. And so because of that, I think it's very special. It's very interesting to see kind of how those roles play out in clips like the Dennis Gray clip, in the christening of the SX Terraplane, you know, in the speeches that she gives, whether she's in front of thousands of people or whether it's just on a radio show like this one or something. It's really interesting to see kind of the different little facets of her, of her soul, really, because she kind of, and she was a poet, and she was, you know, she had her own luggage line, and she did all these other things. She was a what would be considered a modern day hustler now. You know, she was knew how to push herself and get her brand out there. So it's interesting to see kind of all that, and that all ties into it. So that's probably some of the most interesting stuff, the intimate stories like the Dennis Gray story that we've kind of discovered and helped bring to the forefront since we've been doing this project.
One of the things that I've always found most interesting about Amelia Earhart is a really small thing, that in every single photograph you see of her, she has a kind of almost a wry, closed lip smile.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't really, so she was a little self-conscious about her teeth from some of the people we've talked to and some of the extended family that we've talked to. She, you know, she had the gap in her teeth, and she was a little bit, I mean, she wasn't afraid of showing it, but she was a little self-conscious of it. I think it, you know, it goes back to sort of her, she was a master at kind of hiding her emotion and kind of a master at like hiding any kind of fear or even for that matter, happiness or anything like that. Really for the same reason that a lot of people believe that her and GP's relationship was not a real loving relationship, even though a lot of the families say they were very loving behind closed doors and everything, but they just knew how to compartmentalize, and they knew business and, you know, business out front, and then behind closed doors, they were more of husband and wife. But I think with the smile, it was one of those things that she just kind of, it was a way of kind of giving a little bit of her emotion without giving it full blown. I think she was very, you know, I want to say that she was just very controlled over her emotions. And I think even when she was, you know, flying, even people have speculated that you know, when she walked away, this is a woman who walked away from 11 crashes, you know, in her career, which is ridiculous at that time. 39 years old, unfortunately, wasn't a long, people were surprised that she lived that long because pilots didn't have a long life expectancy. So I think she was just really good at showing, at kind of masking her emotions and just kind of showing off just a little bit of what you wanted to see. And just kind of, maybe it was a way of maybe playing the reporters and stuff too at the time. Maybe she had a little bit of that in her, maybe a kind of a performance act in a way. But I think that it was just one of those things that just kind of was part of masking her emotions a little bit.
Can you talk to me about her relationship with Charles Lindbergh? Did she tire of the comparison between what she was doing and Lucky Lindbergh?
I think she, she definitely respected Lindbergh. I don't think she liked the comparison to the, when they called her Lady Lindy. I don't think she liked that comparison because she wanted to make a name for herself. She was a woman. She was very, she was very happy that she got to go on the Friendship Flight, but she was not happy with her role in the Friendship Flight. And she was technically the first woman to cross the Atlantic on the Friendship Flight. And of course, she broke that record later and became the first woman to fly over the Atlantic, transatlantic solo in the Vega. But I think what's interesting is she didn't, you know, she wanted to make a name for herself. So the Lady Lindy thing, I think she kind of just tolerated it. It was a marketing tool. It was something made by, you know, created by GP, who was, you know, say, hey, look at, Lindbergh did this flight 5 years before you did, and he's a, you know, he wrote a bestseller which was published by GP, ironically. And so I think George Putnam wanted to find kind of his Lady Lindy. That's what he wanted to find. And so when he kind of christened her Lady Lindy, I think she was like, kind of maybe taken aback by it. But I think she was smart enough to understand that, well, it is a marketing tool. And she was smart enough to sort of play the game even back then. Like, okay, if it's Lady Lindy is going to get me to that level that I need to be at, then so be it. But Lady Lindy went away, I think after the transatlantic flight, when she broke that record and she started just breaking all these records after records, I think the Lindbergh comparisons kind of just dissipate at that point. And then it became about, you know, the first woman to do this and the first, you know, as opposed to the first pilot. And so I think she started becoming more independent at that point, and it started making her own sort of, you know, her own career and her own kind of legacy at that point.
Chris Williamson is the producer of a upcoming 14-part documentary on Amelia Earhart, her life and her disappearance. Chris, where are you in terms of a timeline for that documentary as far as production and release?
Yeah, so the documentary will be finished fall of 2019. We have about 200-ish hours of footage right now that we're sifting through, and we are going through the process of acquiring footage that we can utilize. Fortunately for us, we have a lot of project guests that are giving us, very generously giving us and letting us use footage that they own of Amelia Earhart and stills and images that they own. That's kind of one of the blessings and benefits of having such a huge project list of guests, because we can kind of pull from those folks and they can kind of offer things to us when we need it. So we have the interviews that we're shooting. We're going to be shooting for another year approximately-ish. And then we will have it done by the fall of 2019. And we'll just, you know, play it by ear at that point.
Many of the project guests in your documentary will be in Atchison at the Amelia Earhart Festival on July 21st. Tell me a little bit about the panel that you're conducting there.
Yeah, so it's ambitious. It's one of those things that if you do any Earhart research, even badly, if you look into the forums and things, you'll see that there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of arguing, a lot of, it just gets downright nasty at certain points. And that's not indicative of what we represent and what we want to be. So I wanted to do something a little bit different. And the idea was to bring a representation of the Chasing Earhart project to Atchison, Kansas. We were there last year shooting a lot of our interviews. And we thought it'd be a good idea to come back this year. I had this idea to do this discussion panel. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to make it like the project itself, and like the documentary, and like the podcast that we do, I wanted to make this the largest scale discussion panel ever on Amelia Earhart. And the way we were going to do that is sort of discuss kind of her impact, her legacy, the disappearance, kind of everything rolled into one. And I thought, how can we do that? And the best way for us to do that were to basically cherry pick certain guests from our list and say, okay, this person represents this hypothesis. This person represents her connection to children, and go all the way down the line. So now we have a representation from Purdue with Professor Sammy Morris, who runs the archives there at Purdue, who runs the Earhart collection there. We have Lisa Cotham, who's the international secretary for the 99s, who's going to be there, which the 99s, if you know anything about Earhart, was one of the club that she helped found and she was the first president of. We have representation from the 99s, Purdue. We have representation from every major hypothesis. We have representation from children's education. We have aerospace. We have air aviation. We have all these different aspects coming together on this incredible panel. And of course, I'll be on the panel as far as representing the project is concerned. But the idea was to have all these people come together and have a discussion. So July 21st, it takes place at Benedictine College is graciously hosting it in the O'Malley McAllister Auditorium. And we are going to put this thing on. And right now we have the reservations are available. You can go to one of our websites, which I can give chasingearhart.rsvpify.com to get your seats and reserve seats for the event, because it's going quick. It's really going to be interesting.
That website again.
So it's chasingearhart.rsvpify.com.
You can find out more about the Chasing Earhart project at chasingearhart.com and more about this year's Earhart Festival at visitatchison.com. I'm Kay McIntyre. We'll have more about Amelia Earhart coming up right after this.